This is the Dungeon Master Guys.
Dungeon Master Guys.
Hello and welcome to the 11th episode of the Dungeon Master Guys podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Dave the Game. With me today is Newbie DM. How are you, Newbie?
Hey, Dave. How's it going?
Good, good. And our chatty DM is not going to be chatty tonight because he's on a family vacation somewhere in the wilds of New England. But standing in for us elsewhere in the wilds of New England is Sarah Dark Magic herself, Tracy.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going pretty well.
You're talking to the Emmy-nominated Tracy.
It's true.
Although you're Emmy, say that. You're Emmy-nominated too, though, so maybe I should just shut up. We're going to have a Royal Rumble here of any nominees fighting it out.
I believe we're all any nominated here.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's one of the exciting things in the world of the Dungeon Master Guys this week is the any nomination for Best Podcast of the Year.
Woohoo!
We're obviously pretty happy about that.
Congrats.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm excited.
Yeah, years open. But before we can get to the Any Awards, we got to get to Gen Con, and the road to Gen Con means packing, preparing games, getting ourselves ready for the best 4 days in gaming. So we've got some great topics to cover today, things related to planning both online games and conventions games, and we're going to answer some reader questions. And so let's get started.
Before we do that, why don't we listen to our sponsor, Obsidian Portal.
Too many NPCs to manage? Players can't remember what happened at the last session? Wasting valuable game time flipping through your notebook trying to find some detail you wrote down months ago? Running a tabletop campaign is hard, but Obsidian Portal makes it easy. With Obsidian Portal, you can manage your tabletop RPG campaign online. Our tools let you track NPCs, locations, items, events, and every other detail for your game. Sign up for free at obsidianportal.com and use promo code DMGUYS to get a bonus.
And thank you, Obsidian Portal. So, Dave and Tracy, with Gen Con around the corner, it is time for DMs to start prepping their games that they're going to run at the conventions. And I know you guys have a lot of experience. And Dave, I know you in particular have experience when you recently took the time to speak to some people that know a lot about this, huh?
Yes, I was able to sit down and talk to Brennan Taylor and Ryan Macklin, both folks very experienced with running games at conventions, also game designers in their own rights. And they gave me a lot of stuff to think about. So let's take a listen. Hey there, this is Dave, and I'm here with two esteemed gentlemen who have loads of experience with GMing at conventions. I have here today Brennan Taylor, head dude of Galileo Games, and lead designer and creator and all that good stuff for the RPG Bulldogs. How are you?
Great.
And also with me here is Ryan Macklin, production manager for Evil Hats, also worked on Bulldogs and any number of other great games, writer, editor, and also experienced con GM. How are you doing, Ryan?
Pretty good, pretty good. Yourself?
I'm great. So I think everyone probably knows why tackling this topic right now is the impending thing that is Gen Con.
So that's coming up? Crap.
Yeah. Someone might have mentioned it previously, you know. But so a lot of people probably in their, few weeks of prepping games, whatever kind of prep that they do. So I figured we'd talk a little bit about that topic. So, Brennan, what do you think is kind of the core of a convention game? What makes it kind of a different animal than just a home game?
Well, just the strict time limit and the fact that you're basically handed a group of all new players that you may or may not know, and you're intended to entertain them for 4 hours.
Very true. Yeah, and sometimes it's strangers, and sometimes it'll be a mix. Ryan, do you have anything to add to that?
Pretty much that. You're given more or less with the format, like 20 minutes to build a rapport between you and the table and for them to build the basic bit of rapport with each other. And that's the biggest hurdle between that and a home game where you already have that.
And plus, there's often this implied thing about, you know, you're going to be not just trying to run a great game for these people, but also teach them rules, you know, maybe even character creation as part of that, which is kind of its own thing.
There's another piece along with the teaching rules. If you're doing a game based on intellectual property, sometimes you have to teach the IP.
Very true.
Not everybody there. I mean, done this with like Dresden Files and Leverage and stuff like that. People show up because they heard it's a really cool game, not because they're familiar with the IP.
Sure, and even with like Bulldogs, I've got to teach them that Bulldogs IP.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, there's always some kind of buy-in beyond just rule stuff. It's also here's a setting, and then on top of the, you know, the full context of the game, here's also where we're going to be playing today, you know, which may be an even more drilled down thing. So with all that that you've got to keep in mind, what do you try to take into account when first in those planning stages? Ryan, is there anything you do to make that process easier for you, or, you know, some kind of template you've come up with?
Sort of. I look at my games these days as a series of set pieces and beats, and I don't really prep beyond that. Like for a lot of the people who've played convention games with me will know that the first part of it is going to be me asking questions about what's going on so that they get some buy-in by defining pieces of the world. Like I'd ask, like, you know, this guy, Javier, he saved your neck. You know, how? And then once everyone's bought in, like, oh, and you're at his funeral, he got shot in the face. Hey, there's a sniper. What do you do? And so sort of like, you know, the crisis moment, and then them kind of figure, like my second beat on that particular framework is them figuring out what's going on. And occasionally getting into scuffles of their own choosing. And then at the end, it leads to the big set piece where stuff happens that sort of, you know, wraps up that, you know, 4-hour story block. And so it's like prepping little skeletons like that is pretty much what I do these days, because any other planning I do more or less gets thrown out the window the moment people start doing stuff I totally don't expect.
Yeah, it's the old saying goes, you know, the plan only lasts until it comes into contact with player characters.
Yep.
How about you, Brennan? Do you have anything that you've worked on as kind of a plan specifically for convention games?
Well, I think it's important to have your prep ready. You know, if you're going to do pre-gens, you got to make sure the pre-gens all are, you know, ready to go and that they all work. And, you know, you got to know your game. It's pretty important for you to be pretty familiar with the rules. I think that's one of the main things that I deal with is prep. And then, of course, yeah, like Brian was saying, that buy-in is pretty important.
Mm. So when you're planning characters like that, like, for example, pre-gens, is there anything that you absolutely must do with those characters beyond just the mechanical stuff, like make sure they're, you know, built right and, you know, understandable? Is there anything as far as like the story behind the characters or anything beyond that that you focus on?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's good for players to be able to get a good hook on the character immediately, right? So you've got to set it up so that players can sort of grab and go. They've got to have some stuff already going on with them so that the players don't have to try and make that up in a very short time frame. So I try to make lots of interlocking relationships between the characters. I think that's probably one of the best ways I've found to get players really going quickly is to have, you know, the characters already have relationships with one another.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, you guys both have run a lot of Fate, which kind of builds that all in, right?
Absolutely. Actually, my Bulldogs pre-gens right now have an aspect that is pointed at another character, but the players, I get the players to fill in the name of which character that is when we start.
Nice.
Yeah. So basically, you know, they sit down and it's like blank is, you know, is distressingly fragile, for example. And, they just get to pick which character they want to have that pointed at.
Sounds like a pretty good method. Ryan, do you have any methods to, along those lines in order to create connections between characters, or, do your questions kind of drive that?
My questions drive that. I ask leading questions, and with a game like Fate, I'll turn them into aspects somehow. There's a great GM, Brian Isaacoff, one of the halves of 2d6 feet in a random direction, is fond of using this method called backstory. It's the question method at the beginning of a con game. And he asked in a game I was playing in, he said, so who's the captain? And I raised my hand because, you know, I felt like being the captain. And then he turns around and says, who's really in charge? We all start laughing. And now whoever picks that, now we're beginning to have, like, implicit, you know, relationships. They're not, like, codified. They're not, you know, set in stone. But we know that we should be pointing at each other, you know. And so with that, you know, and I've taken that and I've used that to things. I've sometimes made it more explicit where I'm like, where I'll say, you know, one of these guys totally just screwed you over at the last job. You know, who was it? And I, you know, like, oh, it was that dude, because that dude, you know, like, awesome. Who really let him down? Because you're going to fall out. You know, I'll ask a lot of questions just to kind of bake in that they know each other, that they've dealt with each other. And if that becomes mechanics, like an aspect, that's awesome. But if that's just enough to give them something to do, to talk to each other as opposed to talk to me directly for 4 hours, then I'm pretty satisfied.
Sure. I mean, even going back in my convention game experience, you know, even stuff like D&D would always have the, you know, the one sheet of, you know, here's your character and here's what he thinks and here's what he thinks about the other players, you know, that has no mechanical effect whatsoever, but it's still something that you can latch onto that character that's more than just the numbers and whatnot.
Yep.
So with these leading questions, do you have like a list of those that you've prepared ahead of time, or is it something that kind of suggests itself as other, you know, as the players are talking or as they're either creating characters or at least filling in bits of characters?
I have like a list of starter questions in my head that I've just done, because I've done this method probably like around 100 times now. And then from there, I just sort of pick on which answers they give. I just kind of riff there. I kind of have like – I know I do like 3 rounds of questions, one for each person at the table. And then the second round is again and then again. And those last two are usually like adjusting and tweaking based on what they've said. But I suppose I should actually write up a list of questions sometime for my blog.
I'm definitely much more of a write it down ahead of time kind of person. So,
do you write those kind of seeds in yourself, or do you plot more of the adventure stuff and then hope the characters will kind of fill that in?
I tend to, you know, prep a lot of seeds, you know, and obviously some of them will get abandoned and some of them will get picked up. But I like to have them all sort of pre-baked in so that people can have stuff to run with. And also I have a little bit of an idea of where it's going to go.
Sounds pretty good. So we've all heard legends, tales, etc., horror stories of convention games gone wrong from both sides of the table. What are some pitfalls of convention games that you should try to avoid?
Yeah, I guess what you want to try to avoid is letting things get a little too, you know, you got to keep an eye on pacing. That's one of the main things I see happen a lot. And one of the main skills that I've learned over time to make my games better is to keep things moving along, keeping an eye on that clock and knowing when you need to put in your, you know, your bangs and, you know, the things that are going to move the plot along and when you need to have that climactic scene to sort of wrap everything up.
I've even been sometimes explicit saying, guys, we've only got like an hour left. Do you want to get to the climax? I mean, if you like arguing in the warehouse, that's totally awesome too. We can totally do that for an hour. But, you know, sort of getting, you know, directing, in a sense, the players as much as the characters for pacing is pretty good, is useful.
Yeah, I also tend to think that games that have, I don't want to say procedural, but kind of along those lines where, you know, there are a certain number of beats that need to happen to really get to a satisfying ending.
Right.
Versus a game that can just be like, well, you know, if I can just get them to the next point in time, we can wrap everything up in one big scene, you know, kind of have a different thing too. So I'll do the same thing where, you know, if I'm like, well, you guys are still this many steps away, maybe you should just kind of dive into what has come up next before, so you can move on to the next thing.
Right.
Yep.
The other things I can think of for ways, some possible ways that you might be able to avoid pitfalls. Low energy. If you're projecting a low energy at a con game, that can really just torpedo it, because then everyone else is going to sort of like eventually match the energy that you're doing. And I've seen like convention games where people have been like laid back, like too mellow, and then just the game sort of slows to a crawl.
I
stand up. I move around.
Yeah, energy is definitely one of the things that I have to, you know, consciously turn on when I get into GMing at a con. That's, you know, if you're not, you know, excited and animated, people are just gonna, gonna drift off, especially later in the con.
I mean, I'm standing up right now while we're talking, because we're talking about GMing. That's right. How I am.
It's ingrained.
And then along with that, sometimes you'll get to where you've got, say, like 4 or 6 players. You're doing 4 or 6 entirely different things, and you're having to play traffic cop between people who aren't actually playing with each other. One of the reasons I stand up is so that I can walk behind a particular character that someone's talking to, because you'll get that time when there are 2 characters talking, but the players are looking at you the entire time and not actually talking to each other. So I'll walk behind one of the people, like the two, I'll walk behind one of them, and that person will stop looking at me because I'm right behind them. They'll look at the person they're talking to. And the other person will look back at me, and I'll just sort of point my finger down at the person's head, like, you guys should talk to each other right now. And that can kind of help. You do that enough, and you stop having 4 or 6 people all trying to, like, funnel towards you, and they'll actually interact with each other more.
So you've got your energy up, you know, you're hopefully not running on the dreaded Sunday morning slots. You are getting all the people to talk to each other. You've got the pacing going. But, you know, if you've got all that stuff down, you know, just as far as the game itself, what should everyone running a game at a convention most strive to do? What's the really key to coming away with that? Not just, oh, that was a cool demo with, that was an awesome game.
I think, you know, just nabbing those moments where cool stuff is happening, and as the GM, you've got to reinforce that. You've got to get in there, be enthusiastic, say how cool things are, and the other players are going to join in. They're going to be talking about how cool other people's moves are, and that's really where all the real excitement, I think, and the stuff that people take away from the game comes from.
Yeah, I mean, be fans of them. Don't be the GM that cackles like, ha ha, I just did horrible damage to you. Look at me in my evil GM face. That's no one cares about that.
That's right.
And, you know, so instead you're like, you know, like, you know, if you, you know, like if one of the players, you know, crits on your monster, like, whoa, son, let me back up. You tell me what happens. You know, oh, yeah, you're awesome. You know, be fans of them. And that really sells the experience that they're having more than anything else.
Yeah, I'd say that if you want to punish random strangers, there are certainly any number of other venues to do it, and trying to run your best convention game is not the time.
And frankly, if you're going to do that, there's far better ways of being paid for it.
Right.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, things that are happening at the table are awesome, and you want to make them more awesome. That's what you're trying to do.
I think that sums it up right there. Just awesome up your game, awesome up your players, and everything kind of shakes out from there. Well, I want to thank you guys for coming on and talking to us today. Is there anything for those of us who are going to be at Gen Con that we should come and check out?
Yeah, I've got 2 things. Come and check out Bulldogs. I'll be running that at Games on Demand. It should be lots of fun. And my friend J.R. Blackwell is going to be running Shelter in Place, her zombie LARP, at 11 p.m. in the Crown Plaza. So check that out as well. It is pretty amazing.
Nice.
11 p.m. Which day? Every day?
I believe it's Wednesday, Thursday. Well, sorry, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
Okay, cool. I will be bumming around Games on Demand, and I may or may not have my Mythender kit with me. So, you know, I may or may not be ready to kill Odin.
Nice. Well,
but I'll be around.
Yeah, if any of those things sounds awesome, if you want your chance to play with either of these awesome convention GMs, come check those out. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So that was my talk with Brennan Ryan. I definitely learned some tips there, but to further it along, Tracy, do you have any big tips for running games at conventions that you can enlighten our listeners with?
Big tips? I don't know. I usually concentrate on some of the smaller stuff. I like to call them by their character names, even though they sometimes forget who they are because, you know, they're playing tons of games and they're sleep deprived. But I give them the bigger index cards to put in front of them so that they can have their name, both their real name and their character's name, so I can easily tell who's who. Because if you're DMing these and you have a table of six each time and you do a few games, so you're going to meet a lot of people and you're just going to forget names. The other thing I do is the initiative tracking trick with the putting part of the index card over the screen, so people know when their turn's coming up, because that's pretty big at convention games, at least. Sorry.
I ran a 4E game last Gen Con. Phil was in it, actually. He was one of the players. And one of the things that I kept in mind when I was running that game is the actual time devoted to your game. Because you gotta think that the players that are playing it have other places to be at a convention. They're not just there to play your game. So my game was slotted for about, I think it was 4 hours. And I knew that I had to have a certain number of encounters in the game and a certain number of things had to happen to make it fit the time based on the number of players I had and what I estimated each encounter was going to take as far as time was concerned. And it's a very important, when you're planning these convention games, I thought, not to over-plan too much either, not to overdo it, because you do have the issue of time.
Right.
The entire day isn't yours and your players. You know, they're not there to sit at your table. So it's something to keep in mind. I ended up running one of the Chaos Car adventures from Dungeon Magazine. And it was basically a three encounter delve, but it worked out just really nice for the amount of time that I had devoted for the game.
Right. Well, and you're going to be dealing with sleep deprivation, particularly if you're running the game later in the convention, both your own and the players. So the more streamlined it is, oftentimes the easier it is to run. And the other thing is to know what kind of game you're running. At least with the RPGA games, they're delves, learn to plays, Forgotten Realms, they're all different types, and each one tends to have a different normal audience. So learn to play people, they don't really know the rules, so you're usually much more open. If you're running the dungeon delves, oftentimes the people know the rules more, and that's really just a, you know, GM versus the people at the table sort of game, and you have to provide a different experience for that.
Yeah, it's always hard at a convention if you're running all for strangers that, you know, there might be a mix of experience levels, there might be people who lean towards one style or another, people who, you know, have learned the game and processed it a bit better, like they, you know, might play all the time at their home game, but they don't necessarily run all the rules when they're there. And, you know, suddenly they're in this different environment too. So it's important to, you know, get to know the people that you're going to be playing with, you know, knowing what kind of game it is important. And then also once they're actually there, what, you know, what they're expecting out of a game and, you know, where they're at and just bearing with the whole thing, I think is pretty important.
So real quick question for you, both of you guys. What do you prefer to run, convention games or home games?
I like to run home games, but I also love to run learn to play convention games, particularly at like PAX East or New York Comic Con.
I have kind of a cop-out answer. Well, you know, I love all the guys that I play with back home. I also really love running at a convention, but for people I know and don't get to play with all the time, because, you know, that's like people I really enjoy playing games with, but, you know, it's kind of a rare opportunity. And, you know, I'm always learning something from different people that I'm playing with. And I know that there's, I mean, for me, I'm kind of spoiled as far as convention games go in some ways, where it really does bug me when I spend some time with, like, if I'm running, I get, you know, some troublemakers at the table, or if I'm playing in a game and the GM doesn't really know what he's doing, you know, I feel like I've only got a small amount of time at the convention. So, you know, when someone wastes my time, I'm not a big fan. So, yeah, that's my sweet spot's in there.
You know what else is fun to run, though? Online games. And I know both of you guys have experience running online games too, right? Or at least playing in them.
Yep.
Yeah.
I had the chance to speak with Daniel Perez. He runs the Dragon Age Oracle blog. And he is going to be producing the This Just In from Gen Con podcast during Gen Con. I had the chance to speak to him about online games. He recently ran a Dragon Age online game. And I wanted to speak to him sort of about prepping for those type of games. And here's how the conversation went. All right, so I'm here with Daniel Perez from the Dragon Age Oracle blog. Daniel, welcome to the Dungeon Master Guys podcast. How are you?
I'm doing good, Enrique. How's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. Daniel, I wanted to talk today about online gaming and organizing and playing an online game. There's a lot of DMs out there that might be a little intimidated by online gaming, and I know that you've done some, I've done some. Actually, we've done some together, so I thought I'd bring you on the show and talk a little bit about that. The type of online gaming I've done has been 4E grid-based gaming, and I'm going to get into that in a little bit. But I know you've done some other types of online games, so why don't we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. My online gaming experience is I've done a little bit of freeform, a little bit of kind of GM-less games, some of the indie games. But when it comes to like fantasy, a little bit more structure, I was playing the Dragon Age RPG. I did an online over Skype game, and we used Google Docs in order to have the maps and some information that I wanted to share with the players. And eventually ended up that when we went to the fights, we used Google Docs in order to keep position during the combat.
How did you actually do that?
We opened up a picture in Google Docs, and we basically just made little markers and just moved them around. We weren't really, I want to call it like grid light, because there was actually no grid, but we were sort of keeping track of position and measuring distances, like guesstimating more or less based on the distances in the map, more or less. And that worked just fine, you know. It maybe the distance of a thumb, it's about, I don't know, 10, 20 feet. It didn't really make that much of a difference, but it allowed everybody to have an idea of where their character was and where the monsters were, and, you know, more or less what they wanted to do and whether they could make it or not.
So let me ask you something, because there may be people out there that have never used Google Docs. I'm assuming that when you update something on Google Docs, everybody else who's seeing that, who's sharing that document, sees what's happening real time to the document.
Exactly. And actually, I had one of the players started doing it by himself, which actually freed me to just keep track of the game and do a lot of other things on my end. So I just basically had to track movement of the monsters. And, you know, sometimes I would mention something that was happening in the terrain. Like, there was this particular combat that we ran, there was smoke coming from one of the buildings, and he went and he kind of drew a little cloud in the area, you know, something rough, but it allowed everybody to see, okay, so there's smoke coming from that building. Good.
Now, so you guys are talking on Skype, you're playing via Google Docs. What were you guys doing for die rolling?
We were using a program called Catch Your Hair. It's a website that has a die roller. And it allows to create a password, and everybody who is using the same password can see the same roles that everyone else is seeing.
Yeah, I've used Catcher here. That's a pretty cool die roller. I'm going to link that on the show notes.
Yep.
That's the one I've used also. The game I've ran a few games online. I've run D&D 4E. I ran one game of Dragon Age, and I played Fiasco online, but I didn't run it. My setup for D&D 4E was with GameTable. I don't know if you're familiar with GameTable.
I know of it, but I've never used it.
Okay, GameTable is a no-frills online program. It simulates a tabletop. You could have it be empty, or you can have it have a grid, like if you had a vinyl mat on your table. That's really all there is to it. There isn't much more than that. It's not like there's a program out there called Map Tools that's very elaborate, has lighting effects and line of sight and things like that. A lot of people use it. A lot of people find it to be the best thing for their particular game. I thought it was too much for my game. So I went ahead with GameTable. It has a die roller built in, so that's what I would use to roll die. And One of the cool things about it is that it has tokens built into the program. So you can assign player tokens and monster tokens. You can label the tokens whatever way you want. You drag them in and out of the table. So for a grid-based game like 4E, it's a very good and quick program to get started. But for a game like Dragon Age, and for the type of game that you ran, which wasn't really dependent on a grid, it was also a very good... It's also a very good program because you could draw on it and everybody sees the drawing at the same time. But, you know, once you start getting into that, you know, it's just a matter of preference, really, because it's the same thing.
Well, the reason that I actually went with Google Docs, I actually was looking at Map Tools because it's free. So I was, you know, let me figure it out, see if I could use it. And I basically ended up wasting like 4 or 5 hours just looking at terrain and looking for backgrounds and looking for tokens. And I was like, you know, this isn't really going to help me a lot. So something quick and easy that will get us playing the fastest, you know, it's exactly what I need. So that's why I actually went with Google Docs in that particular case. If I was doing a more like regular game online, then yeah, I would probably invest the time in learning map tools and setting up all the library of you know, graphics that I'm going to be using.
Yeah, I found it for me. I mean, this is a personal opinion. I know there's a lot of people that like the game again, but I found it for me, it was a little bit too much for what I needed. Mm-hmm. I remember reading somewhere, I don't remember where it was, somebody wrote, if I needed lighting and particle effects, I'd play a video game. And that's kind of how I felt. It was just too much. So I found GameTable to be just such, it's free, even though MapTools is free too, but it's a free program. It does everything. I fixed my maps. I fixed them up in Photoshop, threw them into GameTable. The scale worked. The tokens worked. It was such a fast process for me.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I said GameTable. It was MapTools that I was using, but I guess the idea is still the same. You know, for a four-hour game that was a one-shot, Google Docs just gave me what we needed to play very quickly.
Now, let me ask you a question. Did you, as a DM, before the game started, did you find what steps did you feel you had to take to prepare for your game?
All I did was put some information that I was going to be sharing with the players on a couple of docs, basically the stunts that they didn't have access to, some handouts that I was going to give them from the adventure, and I made screen caps of the maps that came with the PDF of the adventure, and I just put them in 4 different documents. That was it, really.
Yeah, that's. I think maybe the lighter the game, the less prep you have, might translate to online gaming as well.
And that's exactly why I like Dragon Age, because I can just prep it in like literally 10 minutes.
Well, yeah, that's a whole other that's a whole other topic for another day. I love Dragon Age 2, as you know. But I wanted to talk a little bit out there about GameTable and the way I prep for the game and what helped me run it. One of the things, and this really might apply to all online games, if you're getting ready to start an online game, always allow some time for technical issues. Every time I would start GameTable, there was 10 or 15 minutes of, can you see me? Can you hear me? Can you see the cursor? Can you see the map? So always give yourself time to get through that, because there's always going to be a tech problem. Also, you want to get to know the players and the character they're playing well. There's also a token library in GameTable, and the way the GameTable program is set up, there's a hierarchy to the directories, where you could put directory inside a directory, a folder inside a folder inside a folder inside a folder. So you can actually build your campaign, and you can build your encounters, and you can build your delves as sort of a directory structure, which I found it to be very helpful for me, because I had like 3 different games going on at the same time. And I could just click on separate folders within GameTable to have access to the tokens and the monsters and whatnot. So you got to be an organized DM when you're running these types of games. But there's another type of game that a lot of people get into. I've never played them myself, and that's play-by-post games.
Mm-hmm.
And that's online gaming, too.
Yep.
It's just a different form. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I've never played in a play-by-post game, and I'd really love to hear how it works.
I'm doing a play-by-post game of Dragon Age right now using Obsidian Portal, because it has forums and the wiki all together, and it was very convenient. Basically, play-by-post is an elaborate form of shared storytelling, which may be redundant talking about role-playing games. But the way that play-by-post games works is that, you know, the game master will set up a situation, and each of the players will then have one post to respond with their actions. And then the game master comes in and, you know, gives the result of what's going on and sort of moves everything along. It's all done via text. It's all done on a very slow pace because the idea is that it's basically open to anybody, everybody's opportunity whenever they have a chance to go online. But it allows for the ability to play a game when you may not be able to make it to a weekly or whatever other kind of gaming face to face, you know. So
now, does Obsidian Portal have the die rolling built into the forms?
It does. You need to be Ascendant member in order to access the forms on a campaign, which means that you pay the yearly fee. But yeah, once you actually have the forms, you do have a die roller tool right on the site.
See, that's kind of interesting because I can imagine the pace has to be slow.
Extremely. But it works.
It doesn't mean it has to be, because I'm sure there's people that are sitting there glued to the form and they're just writing, you know, and it's happening almost in real time too.
It can happen if, you know, everybody makes a concerted effort to sit down and do that over a session. But in general, yeah, the idea of the play by form is, or play by post, is that, yeah, it happens on a very slow pace and everybody can check it whenever they have a chance.
Yeah, because I mean, if that's what I said, if that's what's happening, what I brought up, then why even bother doing it on a form? I mean, for that, open up a instant message window and play via instant message.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which, I don't know, do people play via instant message?
I have no idea. I would imagine so. They played via IRC.
I think I remember AIM having a die roller built into it.
Yep.
It did, right?
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that a lot of other ones do. I don't do a lot of instant messaging, so I don't know. But I am absolutely sure that if there is a way to do it, there is someone out there playing on online games that way.
The one thing I can never get past when I've played the few times I've played via Skype and game table, at the end of the day, you're hearing people's voices, but you're not really seeing their faces. And you sort of lose that thing you get at a gaming table when you're all sitting around the table playing.
It takes a long time. I played a game of Lady Blackbird with four friends, and we played basically over a period of, like, I want to say 6-8 months, maybe somewhere in between. And we know each other off, you know, in person. We know each other off the game. And even so, it took a couple of sessions before we started to pick up the audio cues on, you know, the way that we spoke, the way that we inflect the certain words in order to make up for the lack of visual cues. It can happen, but it takes time. Yeah.
Yeah, it does take time. But for many people, it's a great replacement for face-to-face gaming, because some people just don't have access to face-to-face gaming.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know many people who play online and they love it, and I've played online, and the times I've done it, I've really enjoyed myself. But it is a different experience. And it takes some organization. It takes some skill, because you're trying to manage a table where you can't see the people. So there is a learning process, and there is a learning curve to online gaming, but I think it's something that once you pick up and once you start doing, it could be a very fun thing for people who enjoy playing role-playing games.
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned Dragon Age. Real quick, let's talk about the Dragon Age Oracle.
Okay.
That is as far as I can see, it's the only Dragon Age blog on the internet, is it?
It seems like it. Yeah, the Dragon Age Oracle was something that was born out of a couple of tweets, actually, that you and I exchanged and with a common friend, Quinn, over the Christmas break. And we said, there's no Dragon Age blog. There should be one. And, well, I put it together. And turns out that over the last 6 months, it's been doing really well.
Yeah, I've written just... To clear it up, I've written some articles for the Oracle, and I really like what you've done with it. And you know me, I'm a Dragon Age convert, so I love some of the stuff you have under the Mystara conversion that's up there, and just some of the articles that have been written. It's just fantastic stuff, and anyone who's got any interest in Dragon Age, they should go check out the Dragon Age Oracle blog that Daniel has.
Absolutely. What I think it's actually the coolest thing has been just finding all the other Dragon Age and Age fans out there who have been doing things on their own and sort of trying to bring them together. I think actually that's been the most satisfying thing for me.
All right, Daniel, thank you for joining me in the Dungeon Master Guys podcast.
Anytime, man.
Take care. All right, so that was our segment on online gaming. And Dave, I know you have experiences in Google Docs for this type of game. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so a few times I've run the Leverage RPG and similar games in that same system, Cortex Plus. And with that one, you know, there's no grid or tabletop or even maps to really deal with in that. Just, you know, when you're running the game, you've got plot points, you know, which are usually poker chips, and then a heck of a lot of, you know, usually post-it notes or note cards to write different elements of the story or different antagonists or different developments and that kind of thing. So with Google Docs, you can set up a little presentation thing and actually just make little text boxes that say, you know, what the different things are with the die rating and just, you know, give little virtual plot points to people and that kind of thing. And it makes it pretty easy. As long as you've got a dice roller, you know, that you can pair with it, then it runs pretty smoothly.
And Tracy, you sat in on one of my games online. I remember when we did the Fellowship of the Tweet.
Yeah.
When I was running my Rule Cyclopedia game. Did you like playing online? I got the feeling when you first started that it kind of wasn't your thing, or you weren't really getting it.
I like playing online because it lets me, you know, play games with you and other people that I've met on my online travels. One of the things that I have sometimes a hard time with online is just it lacks that physical, the social cues that you see when you sit at a table. And particularly when I GM, because that's what I usually really pick up on, I sometimes have a harder time running games online or playing in them for that matter. But I do like it.
Yeah, Danny and I spoke about that in a segment. If you heard, we talked a little bit about the visual cues. And like you said, you kind of learn to pick that up as you play online a little bit more and more. And one of the things I mentioned in the segment was Google Plus with its Hangout feature. And I think that's going to be a big deal in online gaming. You know, if you can look at the people you're playing with, all four of you at the same time or all five of you at the same time on a screen, I think it gives you that sort of social connection you're talking about. And that's one of those tools that I'm really looking forward to using for online gaming in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they announced that there's going to be some kind of Google Doc integration, which could really make it a home run, you know. You've got Hangout, and then you're posting maps to your circle and whatever other developments. I think it'd be pretty great.
Yeah, I'm really thinking of ways to use Google Plus for gaming, and definitely the Hangouts is one of the main things I'm looking at. Because it's true, like one of the big deals about D&D for me is the social thing. You know, your friends sitting around a table and you guys are half playing, half talking smack and having a good time. And a little bit of that gets lost when you're playing online, especially if you're playing with strangers online, and eventually you become friends with them and you get to all know each other. But the feeling, it's always a little less, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but there's always something missing. It's a good option for a lot of us who don't have a group to play with here at home or whatever, but there's just always something that doesn't quite. And I'm thinking maybe the ability to see people's faces might go a long way towards taking care of that.
Mm. Yeah. I also think that particularly with the virtual table and maybe with map tools and other programs, if you're the type of person who likes a more mechanical game, like you're focusing more on that sort of thing, it works really well.
All right, so what do you guys think? We hit some listener email. We have an email here from Joel, and Joel writes, "How do you react when someone is reluctant to try playing D&D specifically because it's D&D? I have friends with a kind of threshold they're hesitant to cross, where D&D is too nerdy, though board games and computer games aren't. From what I know of them and their interest, I think they'd have a great time, and it would be fun to have them as players once they got into it. This ties in with how people react to D&D and knowing that I run games. Some have an instant revulsion, but when I ask about it, they have never played, seen it played, nor even know anyone who has played. So what's your perspective on this? Do you think gamers should do something to change stereotypes or ignore people who pass judgment in ignorance?" It's a great question. Yeah. What do you think, Tracy?
What do I think? Oh, man. I just usually work on people for a while. I think sometimes it's easier for me to get someone to play, just because I'm often seen as the type of person who might not play. So the fact that I do it just cuts that nerd geek stereotype a little bit already. and then, a lot of times people are just they'll say that it's just because it's a nerd or a geek thing, but what they're really afraid of is looking silly because they don't know the rules and stuff like that. So if you can, I think, lower their fear of that and maybe entice them with a type of story that they're really interested in, that could go a long way towards helping.
I've never really had any friends of mine who don't play D&D see it as anything but just another game that someone plays. I've never really felt that judgment coming from people. And the people I play with D&D now here at home are people I've been playing with D&D for 20 years, so I don't really get that. I don't really get what he's seeing here in this email. It doesn't happen to me, thankfully.
And I'm generally pretty fortunate. Yeah, I have the opposite thing as Tracy, is everyone knows I'm a big nerd and, you know, I look like one. But there's a guy in my gaming group who, his wife and he play World of Warcraft all the time. And, you know, they play other video games and watch sci-fi and fantasy stuff. And she's played Call of Cthulhu, but she has the line set at D&D. D&D is just too nerdy. You know, like, it's just over that line for everything else. So, we haven't really, tried to get her into a game specifically. But what I would say for, you know, anyone kind of having this problem is to set up a session that, you know, nothing beyond, like, don't say, we're going to have a campaign, do you guys want to play, you know, make it, we're going to play once to see if you guys like it, you know, set the expectations there. And then don't take it too seriously or make it too overwhelming. Just be like, well, you know, it'll be like a fun game. It'll be like we're hanging out, maybe have some drinks and food and other stuff around and plan something that's, you know, maybe a little more off the wall to get people into it. Like, I think Gamma World's a great game for that, but, you know, it's not actually D&D. And then just get that rolling. You know, as I said, don't take it too seriously, but also try to craft an interesting story while you're doing it and, you know, see if they get hooked or, you know, if it's just not worth it after that.
You know what I find to be a great tool for pulling people in, and I'll give you a quick example. I've been watching with my wife Game of Thrones. We're pretty hooked on it. I loved it. I thought it was a fantastic series. And my wife loves it too. She really got into it and she was, she loved it. So I told her, I go, you know that there's a game for that, right? There's a D&D version of that. And I was referring to the Song of Ice and Fire role-playing game by Green Running. And she was like, what? And I'm like, yeah, there's a role-playing game for Game of Thrones where you can play a house and you create your own house and you guys play in that world. And she was like, you know what? I'm willing to try that. And she's not a D&D player. My wife doesn't game with me. She has zero interest in D&D. But something that was in the pop culture that she liked has a link to D&D. And she said, you know, I'd be willing to play something like that. And the same thing happened to me at work. There was a guy that loves the Game of Thrones series. He's never played D&D. And he's like, we were talking Game of Thrones today. And then he tells me, but that's not really what D&D's like, right? And I'm like, well, you know, it can be. Absolutely, it can be. And he's like, really? Oh, I might get into that. So pop culture is a very strong pull for people, I think. And it might be a good way to get people into D&D.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I for a long time wouldn't play D&D. And it wasn't because of the nerd thing or anything like that. It was just some decision I'd come to when I was a kid. It was what my brother did, and I wanted him to have this special thing. And I just stuck with it for whatever reason. And by the time I got to college, most of the people were very serious about D&D. That it was just like, I'm not going to learn all these rules right away, and I'm just going to ruin the game for you guys. That was my other big thing. I was afraid of ruining the game. And so when I finally listened to the podcast and they were just having fun and at least one of the guys had never played before, I was like, oh, well, maybe I can do this. And then the other thing is, when I did New York Comic Con, I ran RPGA games, and I was tempting people to come play because you could see them walking by, and like, they wanted to play. They wanted to try it out. but they were so afraid because they didn't know the rules. And, you know, sometimes people can get very invested in the rules, and it kind of can put those people who might be interested off. And I was like, listen, we'll teach you. That's the whole reason we're here. You know, just come. It's going to be an hour or two. And the fact that the low time commitment and the fact that we were saying, hey, we'll teach you this, got a lot of people in, and they tried it out. And a lot of them really loved it.
Dave, we have some Twitter comments.
Yep. So got a few here. First one is from @GenCon4James. And he asks, what techniques in 4E can be used to make a game enjoyable for a mixed group of both role players and min-max power gamers? Which I think that's kind of a classic question that doesn't necessarily have to be just 4E.
Wow. Player spotlight, I think. Tracy.
I don't know. yeah, player spotlight. And then, you know, mixing up the type of encounters, but trying to make sure no one encounter takes up too much of the overall time, which is kind of like player spotlight, but slightly different.
Sure. It's time management in a different way.
Yeah, man, I was running 7 to 8 players 4E when I was at the height of my 4E campaign, and it was tough.
Yeah.
It wasn't easy. But you know, I got thrown into that fire, and I learned a lot by doing that. But it wasn't easy. You got to manage all these different personalities and all these different play styles, and it's knowing how to mix it up and striking a fine balance between the type of encounters, like Tracy said, that you throw in your game.
And I would say my group, you know, is pretty mixed as far as preferences go, although I generally take exception to, you know, people saying you can either be a role player or a min-max power gamer, because, you know, I know plenty of people who are both, including in my game. But I think part of the key is to have something pretty much everywhere for, you know, everyone to be doing. Even if it's a big combat that you have planned, you know, there's always chances to put in extra role-playing stuff or extra skill or puzzle stuff. You know, like there can always be runes to be deactivated or mysteries to uncover that, you know, are helpful for doing during the combat, or, you know, captives to be rescued, information to be gained, all that stuff that just takes it out of just being, you know, hack and slash, you know, use your combat powers and brings it into a larger context.
4E is the kind of game that you really have to manage your time well. And you really have to, when you want to put the spotlight on players, it's a really a fine balance. That's the experience I had running 7 people. And I couldn't, you know, there was no way that I could get all 7, give all 7 players in any given night each a spotlight. It wasn't going to happen. It's hard with that many players.
Yeah, I'm very anti-big group for any number of reasons, and that's just one of them. It just never seems like, whatever game you're running, that there's enough time to put the spotlight on enough different people and, you know, mix things up enough and give everyone attention. So I think it tends to work a lot better with smaller groups anyway.
You know what happened? I loaded up my game with people assuming people would drop out after a week, and they didn't. So I got stuck with 7 people.
You were too awesome.
I was too good. Yeah, I was too good. Lucky me. No, I think there was just a real hunger to play D&D no matter who was running, and they stayed. Good for me. I mean, I enjoyed having them, but it was just a lot of people to manage. Now I got a 4-person game. So
it's probably a bit easier to manage.
My Dragon Age game is 4 people, so it's a lot easier. Yeah.
So our next question comes in from @QSTOR2 and asks, how do you get your players to eat healthier?
I give them coupons to Subway. I don't know. I don't eat healthy, so I don't even try. I don't know.
I'm the vegetarian in the group, so, you know, my eating habits don't tend to overlap with the rest of the game group anyway, you know.
I mean, I'm a bad guy to ask. I mean, I have a bag of fried chicken sometimes. I don't know. That's not. I don't get them to eat healthy.
I will go ahead and plug Geek Stream Girls forum +5 charisma plus +5 CHA.com, which is a group of gamers who are trying to lose weight and eat healthier and all that other stuff. And, they've got a lot of good info there. So say go there and, you know, probably know more than we do.
Yeah. And although I know, Tracy, you cook for your players, right?
Yeah, I often cook for our game. And so I try to make that pretty healthy. For a while, we had a guy who was a vegetarian, so we did both meat and vegetarian dishes. And then a couple of the other guys in my group are more health conscious, so they're usually the ones that bring the snacks. So that helps a lot, too.
So what's the signature dish at the Dark Magic household on game night?
Well, usually it's ever since I moved from working at home to working in an office again, it's whatever the slow cooker can make for during the day. But before that, it was like roast chicken.
So you leave a chicken cooking in the slow cooker all day while you're at work, and then.
Yeah, or something. Yeah, stew.
Do you still have someone who, even though you've prepared like a healthy meal, will still come in with like a 12-pack of Mountain Dew and chug that down during the evening?
No, most of the guys in my group are a little beyond that. If they bring soda, it's usually diet soda. They drink a fair amount of beer, but that's about it.
We don't drink beer during our games.
Oh.
But I think that's because we play on Wednesday nights. And when they get out of here at midnight, nobody wants to be driving home drunk on a midnight on a Wednesday night.
Yeah, we usually don't go quite so long. We usually tire out around 10 or 11, but we game during the week. Nobody goes home drunk, though.
No, really what we eat mostly at our table, kidding aside, I don't really eat fried chicken while I'm playing. We eat a lot of pizza, and sometimes we have like chips and dip or whatever. And a lot of, we have a payway by the house, so sometimes we'll get payway.
I was remembering college where we'd get like one of the big cubes of Mountain Dew and then go through that in a single gaming session. You know, there were only like four or five of us and not all of us drank it anyway.
You know, Mountain Dew has a big gamer reputation. We never got into the Mountain Dew here. I don't know if it's a Miami thing. You don't see a lot of Mountain Dew here.
It was only college in Ohio, I would say. You know, it definitely hasn't transferred back to my group now, but still thinking back, I'm like, wow, how did I drink that much soda in, you know, a couple hours?
I think the funniest unhealthy story, if you give me 30 seconds to say it, the funniest unhealthy food story I ever had related to gaming was one night we went to pick up a friend of ours to go game at somebody's house. And we're driving in a pickup truck and we drove by a supermarket. And the delivery truck, this was about 10 o'clock at night, the delivery truck had left pallets of donuts outside the supermarket doors. And I think you know where this is going. We pulled up the pickup truck to the to the doors of the supermarket and started loading it with donuts. So we pick up our buddy, and the bed of the truck is full of donuts. And he gets in the car. He gets in the truck. He's like, "What the hell is this?" I'm like, well, you know, the supermarket's by your house. There were donuts outside. You know, you can figure it out. So that night we definitely did not eat very healthy.
All right, well, that was we probably told you what not to do in the last few stories there. But anyway, so at an extended rest asks us, tell us about a time when your game just came together perfectly and you really felt awesome as a DM. Tracy, do you have one of those?
When basically they were going to this island castle thing, but it was when I was just starting out DMing, and they just got hooked into the story, and I was able to change my voice from, you know, the not so confident DM standing behind the screen to like actually telling a story, and they it was a cliffhanger, so they just wanted to know what happened next, and that was nice. Just awesome.
Newbie?
I ran a siege game in Dragon Age recently where they were defending a wall of a town, and they really got into it. I had never seen them get so like involved in the story. Like they really wanted to know what was happening, and they kept asking me for like to be more descriptive and be more, and I could see that they were really getting into the story because it was kind of like an epic ending to a story, and they were defending a town, and they were going to be the heroes, and all these guys were coming over the wall, these darkspawn, and they were just slaughtering them as they came up, and doing all these stunts and throwing people over the wall, and it was kind of epic, and I could tell that was one night that they were really into the game, and I was really flowing with the combat and the speed and keeping them involved, and it was a fun time. I wrote about that in my blog. There's an article about that at noobydm.com.
Sounds pretty awesome. You called it like the equivalent of Helm's Deep, right?
That's what it was. It was like It was like a Helm's Deep type session. Yeah.
Cool. The one that most comes to mind for me is the one where I won the DM challenge. Not to keep riding that wave, but it really did feel like everything clicked. You know, it was a group that some of the guys knew each other and some didn't, but they all immediately kind of got along. The opening deals with a lot of NPCs, which can kind of be tough to manage, but, you know, each of them had enough hooks that the players were interested in interacting with them and kept them all straight. And then the ending fight, you know, one of my favorite things as a DM is when you put out this challenging situation and, like, people are pacing around the table and, you know, like, talking stuff over when it's not their turn and, like, well, I'm going to do this next and, you know, like getting up to get a better look and all that other stuff. And, you know, I just love when that kind of thing completely comes together and, you know, you can see that the players are so engaged that, you know, they're not thinking about any of the other stuff that might come up during the game. Okay, we've got one more question here from Twitter. At Sith Lord Yoda asks, in 4E, what would you suggest to make money more usable? He says he's implemented the old AD&D price list for armor and stuff, you know, to try to prevent plate and stuff early on. I also think that if you're doing like a Dark Sun game, that might be something that you play with a bit. But any money tips from you guys?
Wow, I remember when I was running 4E, my players kind of ignored money. I don't know, we were stuck in dungeons for so long that they didn't really care. So I'm not very good to answer that question. I didn't have a lot of time to have them use their money. Tracy?
Yeah, we didn't really keep track of money in our game either. I don't think my players were overly into it. And they got most of what they wanted through treasure parcels. So I guess maybe not giving them what they want might help them want to deal with money more. I don't know. That sort of thing is something I often just leave out because it's not as much fun for me.
Well, you know what it is? No one in my game really likes tracking stuff anyways.
Right.
Yeah. So
they argue amongst themselves about who's going to write down what and keep track of what. So, and I'm not going to do it for them. It's not my job. So.
Yeah, I feel the same way as you guys. And in my game, you know, we were tracking it for a while and we had the Halfling Rogue volunteered to keep track of the bank, which is kind of a mistake in the first place if you think about it. But then also his player stopped showing up too, and he was the one that had like the records leading up, and then we tried putting on the wiki, but it was all just bookkeeping stuff that no one was really interested in. So I always like to think of alternatives, especially now that I'm running an epic game, and it seems kind of silly to be like, you get 3 million gold from this dragon. So I've tried to make it, I mean, I started using inherent bonuses, which I think is a great rule, so that when you do give away magic items, it feels more tangible. And just overall, giving money more, not as like, here's what you need to buy stuff of your level, but here's the money that you can freely spend on other story stuff like castles and bribes and, you know, boats or all the cool things, or, you know, any kind of extra story thing, or even like if you're buying stuff that matters for an adventure, like if you're going to somewhere cold and your players want to buy winter clothing, then, you know, you sort of have money to deal with that. But overall, just, you know, make it more interesting than what it is if it bugs you, you know?
Yeah. My players, one thing they wanted to do was to take they wanted to get a little extra treasure, but they wanted to put that towards helping the community.
That's cool.
I mean, I could, they, they didn't really need the extra treasure, but so that would, I guess, would be one way. I mean, I've looked at some of the older books. There used to just be a lot more equipment available of all different types and price levels, and in 4E we really have limited price lists. Like,
yeah, it used to be a lot more detailed, I think, the equipment you could get.
Yeah, you would buy a cloak that was meant for assassins versus one that was meant for someone else, and I think that's kind of cool, but you'd kind of have to, it's an exercise left to the reader.
Yeah, we used to make fun of a lot of that stuff in our games, like, oh, I got 1,000 gold, I can now buy a water clock or a spyglass. Yes,
right.
You know. So, I don't know. It might just be our group that it's never really appealed to focus on a lot of the minutiae of equipment. You know, like, I've written articles about how much encumbrance systems in role-playing games and video games and elsewhere kind of bug me. So, I don't know if that answers that question, but I think there are other options out there, and I would just say don't keep it as a... I would not call money in D&D, you know, the actual tracking gold piece and stuff, a sacred cow. It's something that you can play with.
Absolutely. All right, guys, I think it's time to wrap it up. I think we've had a great episode.
Yep, I would agree.
And why don't we remind people that we are an Any Nominated podcast, and voting opens on July 15th, and would appreciate if you took the time and honored us with your vote.
We're down there in the best podcast category, and I'm sure Tracy and I would both appreciate if you voted in the best blog category. I won't say for whom. Be sure that your vote is known in that category.
Yeah.
You guys are both nominated for a blog. I told the Any people, I said, don't nominate me this time. I want to see Tracy and Dave fight it out.
And that's very noble of you.
I like to help my friends. I said, don't leave me out of it and give it to someone else. And I want to see these guys fight it out. And there it is.
Well, if Critical Hits wins, I'm just going to take part credit for it because I wrote a few posts for you guys. So
it's true. That will probably be the entire reason we win, actually. It will be because of your posts.
Well, you guys are both awesome, and you guys both deserve the nomination, and everybody nominated deserves it, but, you know, you guys are on the show right now, so you guys are both awesome, and you guys both deserve it. So good luck to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And good luck to us here at the Dungeon Master's Guide podcast.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so we are, people have asked, you know, where we've gone. You know, we haven't done a lot of regular episodes lately, but just because we've been really busy with actual, like, you know, game design work and stuff. It's kind of crazy. But we're going to keep going on. Hopefully have some stuff for Gen Con. So if you want to reach us, you can email us at dmg@critical-hits.com. You can leave a comment on the show notes at thedmguys.net or leave a voicemail at 305-349-3026. That's 305-349-3026. Be sure to mention it's for the DM guys.
All right, Dave. All right, Tracy. I think that'll wrap it up for the show. From here, we have Gen Con, so I'm sure we'll have a show post-Gen Con. And I'm going to see both of you there at Gen Con, so it should be a good time.
Definitely.
See you guys there.